good afternoon. This is Bob Kruger with Thought for Food for April 2020. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It's intended for a blind and print-impaired audience, but hopefully it'll be of interest to everyone. Because of the contravirus, we don't know when and if this program will be aired. We'll prepare the script for a later broadcast anyway. And because we've heard so much about the contravirus and all of that, I want to just tell you about a couple of very interesting gentlemen. In the glittering expanse, that's the Angus Barn with its three kitchens, its famous wine cellar, its second-floor bar lined with turkey-shaped whiskey decanters, Walter Royal's favorite spot is an unassuming one. Upstairs on the catwalk leading from the Wild Turkey Lounge to the banquet hall, there's a table tucked into a nook, likely lost in the lively chaos of Angus Barn dinner service. It's both at the heart of everything and hidden away. Perhaps nothing could be more Walter Royal, who's been the executive chef of this iconic steakhouse for the past 25 years. In that time, the Triangle has grown into a rich and diverse dining scene, increasingly recognized nationally for its restaurant community. A chef like Mr. Royal is sometimes lost in the glitz and acclaim of now, but his pedigree in the kitchen has very few rivals, counting two of the South's cooking icons as his mentors, and a career that makes his case as perhaps Raleigh's first celebrity chef. The truth is, Walter Royal wanted to be a farmer. His grandparents were farmers, and as a kid in Alabama, he'd spend summers with them, tilling and sweating in the sun, fishing in the afternoon, getting his hands dirty, and eating for the earth. For lack of a better word, I felt free, he says. But his parents, as parents sometimes do, said no, having seen the harder side of farming and wanting something better for their kids. His mom was a social worker, and his dad taught at the Tuskegee Institute and owned a construction company. So Mr. Royal, the youngest of five children, went to college, earning bachelor's and master's degrees in psychology and playing some football along the way. When he graduated, he set out on a career in mental health. It's something 40-plus years ago that was needed, Mr. Royal said. It appears to me that people need help. We all have our weak points, and as humans, we should reach out. But quickly, Mr. Royal felt the call of the kitchen. It was something he'd felt since he was a teenager, eating delicate tea cookies of his grandmother. The magic of butter and sugar was as strong as anything on this earth. His parents saw professional cooking as a dead end for an African-American man from Alabama. But their son's seriousness, call it stubbornness, won out. One of the things they were reluctant about, there were no African-Americans at the top of that field, Walter said. I had to show them I could survive and be okay. Just like most parents, they wanted the best for me. He left the world of mental health and enrolled in a three-month-long cooking school in Atlanta, led by one of the godmothers of Southern cooking, Nathalie Dupree. Growing up in rural Alabama, there was nothing but barbecue, fried chicken, and stuff like that, Mr. Royal remembers. I needed to get my hands on other good food. Not to say that fried chicken and barbecue wasn't good, but there was more to Southern cuisine than that. Ms. Dupree, who now lives in Charleston, South Carolina, had written more than a dozen cookbooks on Southern food and won several James Beard Awards for writing. She said Mr. Royal stood out in her school. He surprised me, he said in an interview. There weren't many young, educated African Americans, male or female, deciding to be a chef. This was before food TV. It didn't have any glamour at that time. You had to leave a sound profession and want to do it. Mr. Royal didn't finish the three-month course. Instead, Ms. Dupree insisted he pack up and move to North Carolina, where famed Southern chef and author Edna Lewis had taken over the kitchen at the Farrington House in Pittsburgh. That decision would bring Mr. Royal to the Triangle, beginning a four-decade career of influence in local kitchens. I didn't give him any choice, Ms. Dupree said. I knew it would be a wonderful experience for Walter, I told him. You have to go there. You have to take this. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Ms. Lewis was renowned in cooking circles and her books like The Taste of Country Cooking are Southern cornerstones today. But Walter admitted he had no idea who she was. The woman he found was nearly 70, dressed in long flowing clothes and celebrating the kind of Southern food he grew up eating. When I first met her, she was goddess-like. We shared the love of food, the love of adventure, not being afraid and get our hands dirty. When I said the love of food, I don't mean the cooking. I mean the growing of it, the history of it, explaining it, having an open mind for it. Nathalie Dupree knew that Edna would be able to pull that out of me. I have to tell you, I'm one of the luckiest people on the planet to have been able to work with Edna. In those rare moments after dinner service, Edna and Walter would sometimes share a glass of Jack Daniels at the bar. Mr. Royal said his mentor was like a grandmother to him, who nurtured and understood a love of food and stoked its possibilities. It was an awakening. To say, okay, this is something you love, you have a passion for something that's in your soul, but you have to let it come to the surface. Edna Drew helped me draw it to the surface, helped me open my eyes, look around, Mr. Royal said. Not only seeing an apple as something that grew and was beautiful, but could be delicious, and you could share it and tweak it, and you could find 30 other ways to prepare it. Today, under Chef Colin Bedford, the Farringdon House is one of the South's most innovative kitchens. The menus Miss Lewis prepared were somewhat more humble than today's menus, but served no less aristocratic. The food was country ham, crab cakes, Vidalia onions, pan-braised broil, the chocolate souffle, and produce grown in the South, picked and cooked when the flavor's at its best. When Miss Lewis left Farringdon, Mr. Royal stayed. Farringdon's owners, R.B. and Jenny Finch, handed over the kitchen to Ben and Karen Barker, not long out of school at the Culinary Institute of America, who had been at Chapel Hill's La Residence for the previous 2 years. We weren't qualified for the job, Mr. Barker said in the interview. Walter was there when we arrived, and he welcomed us and made our change to a new place easier. He became a good friend and teacher on how to make Farringdon work for us. When the Barkers left Farringdon to open the legendary Magnolia Grill in Durham, Mr. Royal went with them. Ben Barker said their James Beard-winning careers might have been different if they hadn't met Walter. He was such a gentle soul and such a strong human being. We could not have achieved Magnolia Grill without him, with his demeanor and sense of humor in the face of daily challenges. Eventually, Mr. Royal left Magnolia to lead his own restaurant, starting with the Southern Cajun Crescent Cafe in downtown Durham. Today, the restaurant's New Orleans menu of gumbo and e-toffee might be an exciting addition to an already thriving food scene, but in the early 90s, it was lost in a ghost town. 20 years later, its space at 317 Main Street would become the original Dame's Chicken and Waffles, one of downtown Durham's most popular restaurants. It was 20 years ahead of its time, Mr. Barker said. What he was doing was establishing his Southern cooking reputation in this restaurant. Downtown Durham was not ready for that kind of a restaurant he chose to do at that time. There are no regrets from Walter, only a tip of a hat to timing. It helped launch me to do other things. It was a building block for me. Mr. Royal also led Claire's Mangum House in Durham's Lakewood and later became executive chef at the inn at Bonnie Bray, an old Southern mansion that had been converted into a restaurant somewhat like Farringdon. While there, he was nominated for a James Beard Award for Rising Chef of the Year. Later, he'd cook at the James Beard House in New York City. Mr. Royal is the third person to lead the Angus Bourne Kitchen and the only one to wear the title of executive chef. Angus Bourne owner Van Ure and her mother Alice set out to hire a new chef in 1997 and interviewed a half a dozen candidates, asking them to prepare a meal and work with the staff. With Walter, it was immediate, Van Ure said. I knew this was the man for Angus Bourne. He came in and won everyone's heart. Since he's been at Angus Bourne, Mr. Royal said he's never felt the itch to break off and open his own place. I've been there and done that and have no desire to do it again. But Walter, now 63, doesn't have any plans that don't include the Angus Bourne. Hats off to a food pioneer. Thierry Moret was 22 when he traded his lab coat for a chef's hat. Now the Belgian scientists use his knowledge of molecular-level crystal formation to create new chocolate flavors and menus for Godiva. The switch began with a discussion with his sister about opening an authentic Belgian chocolate shop in Chicago. The year was 1982, and Mr. Murray was an industrial chemistry graduate who knew nothing about chocolate. To prepare for his new life in the United States, he landed a chocolate-making apprenticeship under a master chocolatier, René Gossens, in Antwerp. The first thing he taught me was how to temper chocolate by hand, and he said, "It's all about crystals." And I told him, "I can actually explain to you scientifically what's going on if you show me how to do it." He and his sister opened their chocolate shop in 1994. Godiva's CEO discovered Mr. Murray 4 years later at a New York food exhibition. He approached Mr. Murray's booth and tasted his truffles. The chef was offered a job the very next day. My question is asked, do chocolatiers need any particular education or training? Usually, the normal path is to do your pastry degree and from then specialize in chocolate and confections. What are the responsibilities of your work as executive chef chocolatier? He answers, I'm responsible for any new product that's going to be put on the market. Usually, we identify consumer trends, and then I generally create a prototype that fits the trend to see if it's suitable for the brand. The brand, of course, is Godiva. Then I show my prototype to my colleagues in marketing and manufacturing, a little bit like the chef's table at a restaurant or hotel. If everything's okay, we start making it. What are the challenges of working with chocolate? Chocolate is one of the most difficult materials to work with. In the culinary world, your windows of preparation are generally pretty large before you really screw up a dish. In pastry, the windows become tighter. You need to respect temperature and time. You need to be careful. In confectionery, especially chocolate, you're dealing with temperature that cannot fluctuate more than one half of a degree Fahrenheit. That's why chocolate making becomes especially. Pastry chefs can handle chocolate, but a pastry kitchen or bakeries in general are not really adequate for chocolate making. You need a special room for that. What skills do aspiring chocolatiers need to succeed? You need to be passionate about what you do, because chocolate is going to be nasty to you at some point or another in your career. You won't be in tune, you'll miss the right temperature or time, and everything you've worked on looks awful. I worked 12 months just to develop one ganache because I couldn't find the right texture and flavor, and that's just because chocolate is such a difficult material. You need to be passionate about what you do, and you need to be patient. And I'm telling you, you come into this field, you will learn the rest of your life. What is the most rewarding part of making chocolate? When your creativity rises above all else. Once I was commissioned to do a showpiece for the Macy's Flower Show in New York. As soon as I had the job, I couldn't let it go. I started working 24/7. The showpiece was very complicated. I woke up one night with ideas for a technique I wanted to try. I immediately got up and went to the kitchen to try it. That's when you have inspiration. That's where the routine is broken. This is a portrait of a person who is passionate about his career. Therese Murray is 59 years old and lives in Reading, Pennsylvania. His official title is Executive Chef Chocolatier. He has worked for Godiva for 31 years and has held the position of Executive Chef Chocolatier at Godiva for 3 years. If you've been fortunate enough to taste the Godiva chocolate, you've tasted some of his work. They call it carb therapy. People are dusting off old bread makers and desperately trying to find dry yeast. The coronavirus pandemic is turning everyone into a baker. It's not as easy as it looks on Instagram. And here's an example of what can go wrong. A lady stuck at home on day 9 of social distancing. She found some flour in her pantry and a bread machine and tried to give it a try. 3 hours later, when she took it out, it was not fine. It was ugly. It turns out my flour was way past due by almost 3 years. I didn't realize flour could expire. Amanda Greer of Orange County, California, had been baking for years when while training to become a therapist. The first time she attempted to make bread, she accidentally killed the yeast instead of activating it. The bread came out looking like a hockey puck. Now that she's gotten the hang of it, baking has become a form of therapy. You feel resourceful and accomplished. The reward of having a successful loaf gives you a type of high. With social media, posting photos of your bread, commenting on others, and swapping recipes give people a connection that they missed while being stuck at home. Still, many bread baking efforts are doomed. In some cases, it's a lack of the right ingredients. In others, it may be a lack of basic knowledge. Ken Forkish, author of The Bread Baking Guide, Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast, and founder of Ken's Artisan Bakery in Portland, Oregon, said some aspiring bakers buy books like his but don't read them. I actually wrote a book that was meant to be read. Eve Hauser, an American University psych major, stuck at home with her parents in Brooklyn, also tried making some bread. It was rock hard and so bad, I ended up not even photographing. Another lesson learned. Sour cream isn't a good substitute for yogurt. For others, bread baking is less a game and more of a coping mechanism. Maya Lewis and John Sandberg were supposed to get married on April 4th in Chicago, followed by a honeymoon in Italy. They had to postpone the wedding until after the pandemic. We're baking through our sadness, she said. She had never made bread before, but after succeeding at homemade naan, a leavened flatbread, during the first week of social distancing, she decided to attempt a braided challah loaf. She was talking on the phone to a friend while making the dough and didn't add enough flour, or maybe it was because she used sugar instead of honey. In any case, it was extremely sticky and it got everywhere, on my watch, my shirt. I thought I was going to have to throw it out. Since it was difficult to find flour and yeast at the store, she didn't want to waste it. She slowly added more flour until the dough became manageable. It didn't look all that good, but it was still real tasty. One of my daughters said, while learning to cook, we eat our mistakes. I have a friend who's a dentist, and when the pandemic forced him to close his practice, his wife told us on the very first day of social distancing, he decided to make bread. Knowing him, I'm certain the results were tasty. When Blair and Marvin started making and selling bread 15 years ago, she promised herself three things. She would never pre-slice it, she would never bake it in a pan, and she would never wrap it in plastic. But 3 years ago, as she's helping out in the one-room schoolhouse where her son Phineas attended the first grade, she realized she had a problem. At lunch, his friends weren't eating sandwiches made from store-ground organic loaves she and her husband baked at Elmore Mountain Bread and sold to local supermarkets. Sure, the students had Vermont churned cheese from Vermont-raised cows, but the bread came from a national bread company made from white flour or laced with preservatives. All these preconceived notions and standards I set for myself, Marion said, none of it mattered. If Phineas's peers weren't eating our bread, then we were doing something wrong. So she broke her vow, using mostly whole wheat flour, stone ground in a mill made by New American Stone Mills, a company owned by her husband. She developed a new loaf, soft, sliced, and sealed in plastic. Everyone should have access to healthy food, she said. We're trying to make something that's recognizable to the general population. It's a way of getting real bread into people's diets. Ms. Marvin and her husband are part of a collective of about 40 bakers, millers, teachers, and wheat breeders who work with the Bread Lab, a famous research center affiliated with Washington State University, which has long focused on developing wheat varieties specific to regions of the country. Using guidelines established by the lab, the collective has pursued a common goal, making a whole grain loaf that's familiar-looking and affordable enough to appeal to a mass audience. The Bread Lab calls it the approachable loaf, but each bakery in the Bread Lab collective makes a slightly different version, informed by local tastes and local grains. Elmore Mountain Bread calls its bread the Vermont Redeemer, after a type of local wheat. Zingerman's Bakehouse in Ann Arbor, Michigan, calls it Loaf State Street Wheat. King Arthur Flour, an employee-owned company in Norwich, Vermont, christened this version Just Bread and published the recipe for home bakers on its website. Whatever the name, the approachable loaf is made in 20 states, from Kalispell, Montana to New Haven, Connecticut, as well as in England, Canada, and Australia. For each loaf sold, 10 cents goes back to the Bread Lab to help fund research. The Bread Lab has set three strict parameters for the approachable loaf. More than 60% of the flour must be whole wheat and can't have more than 7 ingredients, all of which have to be real food, not chemical additives, and it can't cost more than $6. Bread is among the simplest and most ordinary things humans eat. It's our prayers. Give us this day our daily bread. It's our wallets, our bread and butter. We each have something we like to eat with our bread. I've always liked bread to eat along with my soup instead of crackers. And alongside my loaf of bread is a big jar of peanut butter. Crises have a way of speeding up the inedible. Packaged foods and other household goods are registering a sales lift from the coronavirus, which will naturally fade once the emergency has abated. But some behavioral changes, such as a shift to online shopping, will be more permanent. The implications for the consumer staples industry were big. In the week ending March 14th, total sales of consumer packaged goods was up 44% from a year earlier. Nielsen data shows sales of dried beans more than tripled, while sales of soup and tuna more than doubled. Vitamin sales rose 93%. Americans generally devote a fairly constant portion of their food family budgets to eating out, around 40 to 45%, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics Consumer Expenditure Survey. Even during the deep recession that followed the 2008 financial crisis, is dipping only by a few percentage points. Shoppers are also getting their necessities delivered rather than stepping into stores. Nielsen, along with Rakuten Intelligence, estimates that e-commerce sales of consumer packaged goods rose 91% from a year earlier in the week ending March 14th. This shift to online shopping was bound to happen over the long run, and the current crisis is merely acting as a catalyst. Many shoppers who try to out grocery delivery for the first time due to fear of leaving home will come back again for this convenience. This idea may work for some people, but as a former grocery and meat worker, I still want to check the crispness of the celery and the carrots and see how much fat there seems to be in that pot roast. Consumers' rush to buy groceries is fueling a rally in orange juice prices, making the usually sedate asset the best-performing commodity in the first quarter of 2020. The price of frozen orange juice concentrate futures trading on the Intercontinental Exchange has surged 24% to more than $1.20 a pound since March 19th, a run resulting from demand on grocery store inventories by consumers looking to stop up on goods in preparation for the coronavirus-related quarantines. We're seeing an increase in demand for our products and are working diligently to ensure we meet this brand during this unprecedented time, said a spokeswoman for Tropicana, a brand of orange juice owned by PepsiCo Incorporated. With the deluge of grocery store traffic putting retailers on the heels, speculators have been betting on further gains in this usually sedate market for orange juice futures, which usually trade at much lower volumes. Also, pushing future prices higher are questions about possible bottlenecks in supplies from Florida or Brazil. Pickers are not going out in the groves to pick fruit for fear of getting too close to affected workers and catching the coronavirus disease, said Jack Scoville of the brokerage firm Price Fixtures Group in a research note in late March. According to the Florida Department of Citrus, Florida citrus growers will produce 71 million boxes of orange, similar to last year's production. Ample supplies of citrus are available from both Florida and Brazil, and any hiccups in transportation for juice and other constraints on available supply are temporary, said Neil Murray, head of the processing communities with the research firm HIS Market. Personally, we haven't found any shortage of orange juice, fresh or frozen. Consumers are stocking up on pasta, rice, and bread. Farm supply lines are disrupted. Countries are restricting agricultural exports. The result, prices for wheat and rice, to the world's staple grains are rising sharply. Difficulties moving grain within countries and across borders, coupled with frenzied buying, could cause the impact of the pandemic on the food market. The price of wheat futures trading in Chicago, the global benchmark, has risen 15% since mid-March. European prices also jumped as quarantine measures in France, one of the world's largest wheat producers and a hot spot for the coronavirus infection, made it difficult to transport grain. Meanwhile, the price of a variety of Thai rice, a benchmark for international trade, jumped 17% since the first of the year. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, say logistic issues, along with the falling value of emerging market currencies, are combining to make grains more expensive for food importing nations. That has the potential to create a food crisis in poorer nations as well as regions hit by the pandemic. The world isn't about to run out of food. Stockpiles of grain and oil seeds are high thanks to a series of strong harvests and the rise of Russia and Ukraine and countries in Latin America as major agricultural exporters. A record-breaking global wheat harvest is expected for the 2019-2020 season, which ends in August, according to the USDA. There's still enough wheat on the planet to feed everyone, said Tom Houghton, an analyst at AgriSensus. But getting it to the right places is proving to be a problem. More eating in and less dining out has created short-term dislocations as food suppliers switch from making restaurant products to consumer goods, according to Dave Marshall, a farm market advisor with Nashville-based broker First Choice Commodities. In France, hard hit by the virus, the grain industry has been struggling with a shortage of truck drivers. Countries who rely on imported grains to feed their populations have ramped up their purchases to ensure they have enough stockpile to see them through the pandemic. Countries right now are showing they want to import sufficient supplies in case of a lockdown. The pandemic could lead to longer-lasting changes in the grain market, with countries holding large strategic food supplies and becoming less reliant on a steady stream of imports. We're running out of time for today's episode of Thought for Food. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Bob Kruger, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. So long until next time. If you have questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's the North Carolina Reading Service at 919-832-5138. This is a difficult time for all of us, and we encourage each of you to be careful, take care of yourself, and if you must quarantine, do it and try to keep a positive attitude while you're at it. Take care.